welcome back to the second half of our episode. I hope you had a fine break. I know I did. How about you, Sean?
I did, but we're, as usual, running long, so let's get right to it. So Claude is now going to give us the plot description for Mystic River.
Yes, so from Texas we go to Boston in a lower middle class neighborhood near the port facilities of the, wait for it, Mystic River. It's 1975 and we have three young boys named Jimmy, Sean, and Dave. They're playing street hockey. Their ball, as they inevitably do, rolls into a street sewer. And when they're unable to retrieve it, well, they're kind of at loose ends as far as what to do, but then they spot a patch of wet concrete nearby and they decide to write their names in it. Jimmy and Sean get their names down, but as Dave begins writing, he's interrupted by a man with cuffs on his belt and what appears to be a police badge. The man complains about kids defacing public property, and when he learns that Dave doesn't live on that street, he throws him into the car, saying he'll be taking Dave to the station and then to his home to tell his mother what he was up to. There's another man in the car wearing a large ring on his hand, suggesting that he's a member of the clergy. Dave is taken away and locked up in a dark basement. The two boys tell their fathers what happened, and they, being no strangers to encounters with the cops, realize something ain't right, and they start to organize a search party. We later learn that Dave was sexually abused for 4 days before he escaped from his captors. Cut to 25 years later, and Jimmy, who is now played by Sean Penn, is an ex-convict and a neighborhood convenience store owner. Sean, played by Kevin Bacon, is a detective with the Massachusetts State Police, whose pregnant wife Lauren recently left him, and Tim Robbins is playing Dave. He's a blue-collar worker who's continually haunted by the abduction and the rape. Jimmy and Dave are related by marriage, with Dave's wife Celeste and Jimmy's second wife Annabeth being cousins. In addition, they still live in the neighborhood and quite close to one another while Sean has moved out of the area. Jimmy's daughter from his first marriage, Katie, plans to run away to Las Vegas with Brendan Harris, a boy from a family that Jimmy despises, whom she has been secretly dating. One night, Dave sees Katie and her friends at a local bar. They have come into the bar quite drunk, to the point where they're actually dancing on the bar itself. That same night, Katie is murdered, and Dave comes home bloodied and injured. He tells his wife that he fought off a mugger and possibly killed him. Sean and his partner, Whitey Powers, who's played by Lawrence Fishburne, investigate the murder, while Jimmy, distraught at his daughter's death, conducts a separate investigation using his neighborhood connections. Sean figures out that Katie likely recognized her killer and that the gun that was used to kill her was also used in a liquor store robbery several years earlier. The detectives visit the liquor store and the owner, played by Eli Wallach, tells them pretty much every detail about the robbery and his suspicion that the masked gunman was Ray Harris, known to everyone as just Ray because there were so many guys in the neighborhood named Ray and all the good nicknames were taken. The detectives question Brendan again about the gun, but Brendan says he doesn't know anything about it. He does suspect that his father is still alive since he disappeared in 1989 because $500 checks have been arriving from a Brooklyn address every month. And when I say Brooklyn, I don't mean Brooklyn, New York City. I mean Brooklyn, the suburb of Boston. Whitey still suspects Dave, who keeps changing the story about his hand being injured, but Sean isn't convinced. Dave continues to behave erratically, which upsets Celeste to the point that she leaves the home and tells Jimmy she suspects Dave might be involved in the murder. Whitey arranges for Dave's car to be towed and impounded. They find blood in the passenger cabin and in the trunk, and it's two different kinds of blood, and they're blood type matches for Dave and Katie. They take Dave in and question him about it, but the fact that Dave reported the car stolen, plus the way they obtained the vehicle in the first place, means that the evidence is tainted. Jimmy and his friends, the Savage Brothers, they're the guys who have been investigating things on their own. They invite Dave to a local bar, they get him drunk, and they confront him when he goes out back to get sick. Jimmy admits to Dave that he killed Just Ray for implicating him in the liquor store robbery, which resulted in his imprisonment. And during that imprisonment, his first wife died and he wasn't there to comfort her. So he's pretty upset about that. Dave reveals to Jimmy that he did kill somebody that night, but it wasn't Katie. He beat to death a child molester whom he found with a child prostitute. Jimmy does not believe Dave, and he pulls out a knife. He promises to let Dave live if he confesses to Katie's murder. However, when Dave admits to killing Katie, Jimmy kills him and disposes of his body in the Mystic River, which is just nearby. Meanwhile, after finding his father's gun missing, Brendan confronts his mute younger brother, Silent Ray, and his friend, John O'Shea, about Katie's murder. Brendan beats the two boys, trying to get them to admit their guilt, and then John pulls out Ray's gun. But just before he pulls the trigger, Sean and Whitey, having connected the two boys to the murder, show up. After a brief standoff, they disarm John, and they arrest both him and Ray. The next morning, Sean tells Jimmy that John and Silent Ray confessed to killing Katie as part of a prank gone wrong. Sean asks Jimmy if he's seen Dave, who's wanted for questioning in the murder of a known child molester. Jimmy does not answer, instead thanking Sean for finding Katie's killers, but remarks, "If only you'd been a little faster." Sean, having been able to put all the pieces together but having nothing from an evidence standpoint, then asks Jimmy if he intends to send Celeste $500 every month too. As they part, Sean's phone rings. It's Lauren again, still not talking to him. Sean apologizes for pushing her away, and she finally speaks to him. She agrees to return and tells him that their child has been born. It's a girl named Nora. Meanwhile, Jimmy confesses what he's done to Annabeth, who goes all mafia wife on him, and tells him he's a king, and a king knows what to do and does it, even when it's hard. During a local parade, Celeste looks everywhere for Dave. She locks eyes with Annabeth, but there's nothing there. We see Dave's son Michael in the parade looking for his father. Sean, with Lauren and the baby Nora, spots Jimmy, and he mimics a gunshot at him with his hand, and Jimmy just spreads his arms in a what-are-you-gonna-do kind of gesture. End of film.
All right, so this is based on a novel by Dennis Lehane. Now, Claude and I know him as someone who wrote for The Wire. Mm-hmm. He wrote one of my all-time favorite scenes on the show, the 40-degree day scene. But he's started out, like other people who wrote for The Wire, as a novelist. First, he was a mystery writer writing with two recurring detective characters, Patrick Kensey and Angela Gennaro. And there's been, as far as I know, one movie to date based on one of those novels, Gone Baby Gone, directed by Ben Affleck, with Casey Affleck as Patrick and Michelle Monaghan as Angela, that came out a few years after Mystic River. Mystic River was the first novel that Lehane wrote that didn't have either of those characters in it. And for the most part, Eastwood and Brian Helgeland, who wrote the screenplay, follow the novel pretty closely. There's a backstory cut out. Another character that who's initially a suspect because he's someone that Katie, who by the way is played by Emmy Rossum, used to date. He's briefly considered a suspect. And then one of Lehane uses one of my all-time favorite songs in his, or quotes it in his novel, Ricky Lee Jones's title track to her album Pirates, Pirates, parentheses, So Long, Lonely Avenue. Eastwood, not being a fan of modern music for the most part, did not use that. But otherwise, he keeps to the story pretty well, pretty closely. And as a matter of fact, Helgeland had initially diminished the roles of Celeste, who's played by Marcia Gay Harden, and Annabeth, who's played by Laura Linney. And it was Eastwood who convinced Helgeland, no, you have to beef them back up again. Put back what you cut out. And at this point in Eastwood's career as a director, and I mentioned when we talked about Fistful of Dollars that I wasn't always a fan of him, either as an actor or as a director. But in this time period, this is about a decade or a little more than a decade after he won an Oscar for directing Unforgiven, which also won Best Picture. And after that, he directed what I think is one of his most underrated movies, A Perfect World, and then a movie that I hope we discuss at some point that no one could ever have predicted he'd direct, but turned out to be really good, an adaptation of The Bridges of Madison County. Mm-hmm. But then after that, with the exception of his version of the nonfiction book Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which didn't quite work, but you could admire the attempt because he was trying to stretch himself in the different areas. And of course, he deserves full credit for casting Lady Chablis as herself instead of having a cisgender person play a transgender role. He let the original play herself because who else was going to play her? But except for that movie, it seemed like Eastwood was treading water as a director. You know, he directed four Potboilers, Absolute Power, True Crime, Space Cowboys, and Bloodwork. And while none of them were bad, per se, all of them have good parts to them. True Crime, until it decided to play straight the ending that The Player satirized so effectively. It felt like Eastwood was punching below his weight. Mystic River, on the other hand, I know there's been some pushback on it in certain circles in recent years, and I'm going to get to why in a moment. But for me, that was the first time that Eastwood had tackled material that was challenging in a while. And I think that he lives up to the challenge. How about you, Claude? Did you like this movie, or are you one of the ones who want to push back against it?
No, actually, I like this. And I this was a rewatch for me, because I did see this film theatrically. I enjoyed it a lot, even
as
then.
As did I.
And yeah, but you saw everything theatrically. So, you know, but this was like, I think, the period of me actually going back into starting, because it was a long while where I wasn't consuming any media at all for a while. It was kind of weird. But so this was like one of my first steps back into going to see movies and that sort of thing. And I enjoyed this. There were a couple of, like, you know, let's say choices that he made, and they all happened near the end of the movie. And I was like, okay, why is he doing this all of a sudden? And it has to do with, like, just changes from one scene to another, which starts with the scene where Jimmy fires the gun and everything goes white. And then all of a sudden we're back in the town and it's daytime. And then there was another transition scene, like at the parade. And it was the same kind of thing. It was like, we're getting clever all of a sudden. And it was a little bit weird, but you know, other than that, okay, I'm comfortable with it. You know, he doesn't do anything else especially fancy, but he doesn't have to. This is a pretty solid story, and it's a little bit of a complex one, too. And so you don't really want to... let me frame it this way. You do want to challenge your viewer a little bit, but you don't want to challenge them in, like, eight different directions at the same time. So you're either going to, you know, hit them with, like, strong visuals, or you're going to hit them with a strong story, and they don't... You don't want them crashing into one another. There are some directors who can pull that off. I don't know that Eastwood is one of them. And so the fact that he chose to play this one relatively straightforward is perfectly fine. I did like, there was also a little bit of parallel action, which I really enjoyed. In the scene where Dave is first picked up in the car, and that's also in addition to, well, not his getting picked up, but the other guy in the car is an addition to something that wasn't in the novel, the suggestion that he was a member of the clergy, because there was a lot of a scandal going on at the time, and that wasn't really in the book. But as he is driven off, Dave turns around and looks out the back of the window as the car goes down the street. And yes, then later on, when he is picked up by the Savage Brothers and he gets in the car, what we see is he turns around, looks out the back of the car, as it goes down the street. And you're thinking, like, you already know this is not going to be good. Not because the Savage Brothers have picked him up, although that's ominous all by itself. But when he turns around and looks back, and you're like, oh, hell, this is not going to end well for him.
Yeah. Now, the transition from Jimmy firing the gun to the next day, I think that is in the novel. So that one didn't bother me too much. As far as the
I'm talking about like the visual cut, like everything goes to white and then we tilt down.
I know, but it didn't bother me. And we should mention that the folks behind the camera on Eastwood Films normally are ones who he's been working with quite a while. Mm. Joel Cox is the editor, and he edited most of Eastwood's movies. Tom Stern is a guy who took over who used to be Eastwood's cinematographer after the old guy died. He was a lighting technician and a gaffer, and then starting with let's see here, when was the first Eastwood movie that he shot? Starting with Bloodwork, he became Eastwood's regular cinematographer. He's worked with other directors as well, but Eastwood is his go-to director. And you're right that Eastwood doesn't use a lot of flashy camera work here, although a few of the flashbacks that Dave has when he's recounting or remembering how he ran out of the woods to escape from his captors, there are some interesting transitions there and some interesting sound effects as well. But those are the only flashbacks in the story. So unlike Sales in Lone Star, who uses flashbacks to show how the past is present for many of the characters in his movie, Eastwood uses the actors and some of the dialogue to convey as how the past is still part of these characters' lives. Now, obviously, the big one, as far as the past goes, is Dave. Because, yeah, as Tim Robbins mentioned in the commentary that he and Kevin Bacon did for the DVD that I own of this movie, that all throughout the present day scenes, because in that scene in the past, when the guy pretending to be a cop, who, by the way, is played by John Dolman, speaking of The Wire, he played Rawls on that show. He told the truth to him that he didn't live on that street, and that's why he got taken into the car. And then also compared, apparently, to Jimmy and Sean, although this is spelled out more in the novel, he's more of a weak-willed kid compared to the other two. But in the present day scenes, whenever Dave is with Sean and Whitey, everything he says to them is a lie or getting around the truth, particularly when they ask him about his hand. You know, that points up to how victims of child abuse aren't necessarily going to always going to tell the truth to anyone. And another way that
right, and then similarly, they basically learn to lie too.
Yes. And, you know, he lies to the only one he's sort of the only time he really tells the truth is when Jimmy is confronting him at the end. And the other thing is that he talks obliquely about his experiences, especially in the scene where he has with Celeste, where he freaks her out so much that that's when she decides to leave him. He's talking about a monster movie that he's been watching, and he talks about his experiences with the people who molested him as if they were wolves, and he was the boy who escaped from wolves. And that's what really pisses Jimmy off when he's confronting him at the end. And when he's finally trying to tell him that he killed the child molester, and he mentions the wolf, the boy with the wolves, and Jimmy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
And he yells at him about that one point. If you say one more thing about the wolves, you know, that's not something that he really understands. But at the same time, you know, we do get a sense of how the past has weighed down on them even before that. You know, even though Tim Robbins is one of the tallest actors who's ever worked in Hollywood, you know, the way he carries himself, for example, when he's walking his son to school, early on in the movie, he's hunched over, mm-hmm. you know, as if even though he's tall, he's sort of defeated all the time, you know, sort of like how the actor who played Neville Longbottom in the Harry Potter movies, even though he grew up to be tall, it wasn't until his character learns to stand up for himself in the last part, Deathly Hallows Part 2, that he stands up normally instead of hunched over, because his character was feeling defeated for most of the books until the last part. And then you've got Sean's line. I think it's Sean who says at one point, you ever get the feeling that all three of us got into that car, not just Dave? And then as for Jimmy, when Katie comes by the store just to tell him that she's going out, to remind him that she's going out that night, and he tells her, you know, make sure you're back so that you can go to your sister's first communion. And then he realizes, you know, he sounds like some other parent.
Yeah.
And he tells her, go out and have a good time. And she gives him a look. And as he tells Sean later in the police station, that was the look that she had given him when he spent the night with her the first time after he got out of prison, the look that she doesn't think she's going to ever see him again. And the way that Emmy Rossum is able to communicate all that in just a look, and that Sean Penn is able to communicate that back to her in just a look, you can see the past is haunting them there. And then also, of course, it's in the way that Sean is unable to really confront or have a conversation with his wife about what they really need to talk about, which is that baby his? And if not, does he care? It's not until the end that he's able to say, okay, you know, it doesn't matter to me if that's not my baby or not. you know, I'm going to love the baby as if it was my own, and please come back. And that's when she finally speaks to him. And I think it's there that we finally get to see her face, because the way Stern shoots those phone scenes, we only see her mouth and her holding the phone.
Yeah,
actually see her face.
We see a photograph of her earlier in the film, but it's not especially clear. It's not like you can look at that picture and say, oh, that's thus and such person.
Yeah, so that's the way that Eastwood and Heligoland are showing the past is a big part of these characters' lives. And they do a good job with that.
Right. And as you say, like, this one doesn't do much with the way of flashbacks, but it doesn't have to. I think in Lone Star, you did have to do the flashbacks because we're trying to piece together a story. And as the pieces come together, we get a little bit more of the backstory, just as Sam gets a little bit more of the backstory. In this one, the past is the thing that just sets up everything that happens afterward. And so the only time we get any real flashbacks is when Dave himself flashes back to his escape from his captors. And it's almost like a flashback of a flashback, because he's telling the story of what happened when he found the child molester and he killed him. And while he is telling the child to get away, at one point you hear "Run, Dave," and you're not sure if he's saying it in the moment or if it's something he was saying to himself in his own flashback. And it's like, it's a nice, cool, very, very layered scene there. And it's so short.
Yes. And by the way, I should have mentioned, Tori Davis plays Sean's estranged wife, Lauren.
Yeah.
Getting back to when Tom Stern finally shows her face, originally there were only supposed to be two phone call scenes between Sean and Lauren. But Bacon went to Eastwood and said, look, there should be another one. And so he added the third, and that helps the final shot of her on the phone when you finally see her face and hear her voice be all the more meaningful and powerful.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable, actually.
Yes. Now, another thing that strikes me about this movie is that final scene at the parade. You know, a lot of people critics, and they were praising us, commented on that gesture that Sean gives to Jimmy, the finger gun salute that he gives, and Jimmy's reaction, which is also meant to show that as much as he's tried to put his criminal past behind him, he's going to be embracing it now. But I also liked the look that happens between Annabeth and Celeste when Celeste is trying to find her son and wave to him, but then she looks across the street at Annabeth. Annabeth, when she was telling Jimmy, no, don't confess, you know, and when she's getting, you called it mafia wife, I call it Lady Macbeth.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of woman would turn in her own husband is what she says. So the way that Laura Linney stares at Marcia Gay Harden made me think of Annabeth is this strong, proud eagle, and Celeste is like a bird with a broken wing. And that was a powerful sequence for me as well. You get the sense of Jimmy and Sean in the novel, but you really don't get that whole thing between Annabeth and Celeste at the end in the novel. That's something I think that Eastwood, even though I haven't read anything for sure to make me say this, but I think that's what Eastwood was thinking about when he told Helgeland to beef back those two roles up. And without that last shot edit between the two of them wouldn't have been so powerful for me.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, like, you know, Linny is she's very subtle in this particular scene because they do look at each other and they hold the look for a long time, and you're not sure what quite is being exchanged between them, and at the same time you can see that there is like a little bit of a power shift going on between the two of them, that things aren't quite what they used to be. I mean, they're relatives to one another, but at the same time, it's like you can, and I, if I remember correctly, also Linny is kind of standing up on stairs, whereas Harden is at ground level. So she also has to literally look up to her in order to do this particular exchange. And so it becomes a literal elevation of one over the other. It's, I love it. I just like it.
Yes. Now, one thing that a lot of critics also noticed about movie as far as Eastwood's career goes, when Unforgiven came out, a lot of people saw that as Eastwood not turning his back exactly on the man with no name, the character he played in the Dollars trilogy, but more like doing a revisionist take on it. And similarly speaking, you could see Mystic River is sort of a revisionist take on his other most famous role, Dirty Harry. Now, I mentioned when we talked about the Dollars trilogy that I am not a fan of Dirty Harry. You know, I will certainly concede that the first movie is a well-made movie. You know, Don Siegel is not a hack director. He's a good director, and he makes that work. But I got ideological problems all over the place with Dirty Harry. You know, and I think while Eastwood's politics have certainly probably gone back rightward again a little bit in recent years. I mean, I certainly can't forgive or forget that. I can't remember if it was Esquire or GQ interview that he gave. And this, of course, is the man who made Invictus, a movie about one of the greatest civil rights leaders ever, Nelson Mandela. But in that interview, he said that anyone who thinks that racism is still a problem needs to get over themselves, which, yeah. But at this time, he was certainly questioning what had gone before, or allowing us to question it. And you can see that here. You know, Jimmy commits an act of vigilantism, and only to find out that he killed the wrong guy. And unfortunately, he's not going to pay for it. And that's not seen as a good thing in this movie either. Whereas in Dirty Harry, I think it would have been seen as a good thing. So that's one way that Eastwood complicates things morally in this movie. Now, although Eastwood is not particularly religious, as he said, I think he said he's either an atheist or agnostic, I'm not sure which, he does have, and this is appropriate for Boston, which, remember, is a predominantly Irish Catholic neighborhood, even though there have been more diverse elements in it in recent years. You know, you've got the whole question of guilt going on here. You know, Jimmy says at one point when he's standing over Katie, I know in my heart that I contributed, something like this, I know in my heart that I contributed to your death, I just don't know how. But that's another way that the movie deals with the past, that the sins of the fathers come back to bite by the children in the rear. Mm-hmm. And that's all very well dealt with.
Yeah, it is. And you know, it's a neat little, there's a few fun little Bostonian touches in this film. You know, you've got the Irish Catholic guilt thing going on. And then there's also a scene with Fishburne and Bacon where Fishburne's complaining about the coffee. He's like, it's the same as Dunkin' Donuts, but it costs like 15 times more. And if you've ever spent any time in Boston, you know that you can stand pretty much anywhere in town, box the compass, and see about a half a dozen Dunkin' Donuts within sight. So it's just a neat little bit there that you know, oh yeah, we've kind of captured this town a little bit. But at the same time, it's also very, very insular, because you're not going to see like Fenway Park, and you're not going to see, you know, nearby Harvard. You're not going to, we really spend pretty much our entire time like in this one particular neighborhood, and possibly wherever this park is. You know, it sounds like it's not walking distance. It's a little bit of a ways away. And that's pretty much it. So in one sense, we've captured the area. And in another sense, we show how, you know, this area, while in Boston, is not necessarily of Boston. It's kind of a neat balance that they've struck here.
Right. And actually, Warner Brothers, the studio that's worked with Eastwood most of his career, wanted Eastwood to shoot this movie in Canada to save money. And Eastwood said,
No.
You got to shoot this in Boston.
No, that neighborhood is definitely, like, as they say sometimes, a character in the film.
Yes. Unfortunately, he had the clout to do so. Mm-hmm. And another way, although this is after the fact, that it invokes Boston is you've got a couple of local yokels who are in this movie who showed up in a TV show that took place in Rhode Island but had quite a few Boston or Boston actors or people with the Massachusetts accents in it anyway. I think the folks who played two of the Savage Brothers were local actors. And the third one, a guy by the name of Kevin Chapman, was also a local actor. He was born in Dorchester, and I first took note of him. I mean, I had seen him in this movie, obviously, but I first took note of him in what I think I mentioned before when we were talking about The Departed, as being in what I still believe is the best Whitey Bulger story, a fictional story ever put on film or TV, and that's the show Brotherhood. He played the crime boss on that show. And then Tom Kemp, who plays a forensic technician, also played a major role on that show. And the actor who plays the young Jimmy, Jason Kelly, he also showed up on a couple of episodes of Brotherhood. So although Eastwood did not maybe go to the extent that Ben Affleck did when he did Gone Baby Gone in casting locals, he did capture the flavor of the town. Now, I'm sorry, did you want to interject something there?
No.
Okay. Now, speaking of the actors, let's talk about Sean Penn here. Now, as I mentioned, there's been some pushback on this movie, and a lot of it has to do with Penn's performance, which won the Oscar that year for Best Actor. Specifically, the scene when Val Savage, which is the name of the character that Chapman plays, break through the police barrier. And Jimmy yells out to Sean, "Is that my daughter in there?" And a lot of people at the time, and especially now, thought that that was rather shameless overacting on Penn's part. Now, I can understand how some people don't like to see people go over the top in acting at all. They require all acting to be more down to earth. But all I have to say is I thought it worked. I thought he was very powerful. No, I would not have given him Best Actor that year. I would have gone with another performance we've already talked about, Bill Murray's in Lost in Translation. Mm-hmm. But I thought Penn was very good here.
No, he did a fine job here. And the thing is, you had to establish early on that, A, he could be a little bit of a hothead, but B, you know, he's losing this daughter, and it's really like his last connection to his late wife as well. So if this is in fact his child, because he doesn't quite know yet, he suspects it. And, you know, I think the way Kevin Bacon responds by not responding is kind of the confirmation that he is getting. Then, yeah, he's going to lose it there. And then when we see him in later scenes where he breaks down hard, you know, we buy into that as well, because we have seen that this is kind of how this guy goes. And so I buy into that absolutely altogether. Now, I'm curious to know now, like, since we're on, like, the various actors, I had heard that Kevin Bacon's part was originally gone to Michael Keaton. And
that's what I just read on the IMDb trivia page, but I'm going to get back to that in a moment.
Okay.
First, I want to talk again about Penn's performance, because what you just brought up reminded me of the later scene where he does break down, and that's when he's with Dave outside at Katie's wake. Mm-hmm. You know, he's talking to him about Katie. You know, first he does the thing that I've noticed that a lot of guys do when they don't want to admit their feelings, when he says to Dave, "Oh, Celeste, she's been such a godsend. Thank her for me, would you?" Mm-hmm. And then he starts talking about Katie and the fact that he really upset over the fact that he can't seem to cry for her while he's crying.
Yeah.
And Dave points that out to him. So that's a really powerful scene. But yes, I did not know until I saw on the IMDb trivia page that Michael Keaton was originally cast as Sean. And apparently he had done a lot of research. You know, he, as we saw in the movie Spotlight, he does the accent very well, the Boston accent. But apparently he and Eastwood got into a pretty fierce argument and he left the project. And Bacon, who had wanted to work with Eastwood, I think I read somewhere that he actually approached Eastwood and said, "You know, I'm such a big fan. If you ever want to, I don't know if I'd ever be right for any one of your movies, but in case you think I am, please give me a call." And so Eastwood called him. And Bacon is an actor who was known for a while mostly as the guy who inspired the Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon game. Because, of course, he's been in so many movies that you sooner or later it could all be connected to him. And when I was considering whether or not to do a trivia question for either of these movies, I latched on to the fact that with a lot of the Lone Star actors, you could actually do a Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon thing. You know, Chris Cooper was an adaptation with Meryl Streep, who was in The River Wild with Kevin Bacon. Elizabeth Pena was in Tortilla Soup with Hector Elizondo, who was in Nothing in Common with Tom Hanks, who was in Apollo 13 with Kevin Bacon. And both Kris Kristofferson and Joe Morton were in Trouble in Mind with Laurie Singer, who of course was in Footloose with Kevin Bacon. You get the idea.
Yeah.
But after his flirtation with being a teen star in the 80s, thanks to things like Diner and especially Footloose, of course, but after his career as a leading actor sort of bottomed out, he reinvented himself, starting with JFK, as a character actor. And, you know, he really showed that in another movie we talked about earlier, A Few Good Men. And he shows it here, because in this movie, he's sort of the conscience of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he does that without overdoing it, as you say, in the way he's reacting to Jimmy getting very upset when he wants to know if that's Katie in the car. And then also when they're first talking to Jimmy and Annabeth at the station, and Whitey brings up Jimmy's criminal past, and Jimmy is like, is that going to help you catch my daughter's killer? Which, of course, in a way, it does.
Yeah.
But anyway, when he gets upset there and bangs on the table, Sean is the one who's calming him down. Kevin Bacon's the one who's calming down. And then when they confront John O'Shea at the end, when he's pointing the gun at Brendan, again, he's saying, he's being calm. He's saying, you don't have to do this. He's being calm with Lauren. You know, he plays that all very well. Even when he calls Jimmy out at the end for not only being the one who killed Dave, but also being the one who killed just Ray.
Right.
With that remark, you know, he does it in a very calm way. And it's an extraordinary performance by Bacon.
It is. And that's why I didn't want to get into any backstory as far as, like, you know, Keaton and why he no longer had the role. But I was kind of curious just to get your take on, you know, bearing in mind that up until then, like, most of Keaton's roles had been like this goofy, cartoony almost kind of guy. And so, I mean, I think his first real foray into something, well, he did Clean and Sober, but you know, okay. But
I was going to bring that up. Yes.
Okay. But after that, it was Batman and Dream Team. And so while Batman is a serious and fairly deep character, and I think he did a fantastic job with it, you know, could he have brought this level of gravitas at that point in his career? Again, having just played Batman for the second time. Okay. Could he have brought it to this particular role?
Later, Claude.
No. Because Batman was 89, right? Batman Returns was 92.
And Mystic River is 2003.
Yeah, but still.
But, you know, after that, he was in My Life, which is a serious movie. After all, it's about a guy who's dying of cancer and trying to record videos of stuff to teach his son while he's gone. Then we've got a movie that we've already discussed, Jackie Brown, where, okay, he's playing Ray Nicolette in an over-the-top way, but it is still a serious character. And then
yeah, but it's also a relatively small role. So I'm
not finished.
Okay.
After that, he played a serial killer in Desperate Measures. And after that, he did...
Say Jack Frost. Go ahead. Say Jack Frost, man.
I haven't seen Jack Frost, so I'm not going to. He did a made-for-HBO movie about CNN during the coverage of the first Gulf War live from Baghdad, where even though he does get to show humor in it, he is essentially playing a dramatic role, and he does a good job with that. So I think he could have done the dramatic part well. What I would have said is that he is older than Sean Penn is, and older, I think, than Tim Robbins is. So it wouldn't have been believable to cast him in the role, because you wouldn't have believed the three of them would be the same age, whereas Bacon, Penn, and Robbins all came up around the same time as actors. Robbins didn't become noticed until a little after Bacon and Penn did, but I buy the three of them as being the same age. I wouldn't buy Penn, Robbins, and Keaton being of the same age.
Yeah, I'll give you that. And then also just occurred to me is, although they're all approximately the same age, Penn is made to look a little bit older than the other two because he's been through more. This is the guy who's been in prison. This is the guy who lost a wife. This is a guy who's had like a little bit of a rougher life. And I think it was said actually that, you know, these kind of things just sort of age you a little bit more. And so it sort of makes sense. And so, yeah, if you get like a Keaton in there who actually looks older than the other two, it becomes that much harder to make Sean Penn look older than the other, you know, as
yeah. And Whitey actually mentions that, you know, that
yeah.
He could tell that Jimmy had served time because he's got that look. But on the other hand, Dave has also been through hellish trauma. Let's not forget. Mm-hmm. And the way Robbins, who was the other Oscar winner here, plays it is also good. You know, he, unlike Penn, who at least gets to show a little humor, not just with the line where he says he sounds like someone else's parent, but also when his daughter is going up for First Communion and he makes that funny face at her, even though Annabeth says, do not make her laugh.
Right.
And then when the daughter comes up and hugs her at the end and she says about her dress, it itches, and he says, it itches me, and I'm not even wearing it.
Yeah.
Now, that's the little humor. Whatever humor Dave is showing is very dark humor. And Robbins is also terrific in this.
He is, and that, as you said, like, you know, he actually carries himself smaller. He's 6'4". Okay. Mm-hmm. And there is a scene. I don't think there are a lot of scenes where the three of them are like, well, there are no scenes where all three of them are together when they're adults.
Yes.
Okay. But the scene there, but I think there's only one real scene where we see him and Bacon standing together and they're actually walking down the street and with Fishburne nearby. And you would still not necessarily know or realize that Robbins has like 6 inches on Kevin Bacon. Bacon is about 5'10", so
right.
It's just, yeah, he can physically transform himself in that respect, and you got to respect that sort of thing.
Yes, and Fishburne is also good. By the way, I didn't mention that he, on the special features of the DVD I had, he joked in an interview there that he was essentially playing Bacon's wife in the movie. until Lauren finally shows up to replace them. And the banter that the two of them develop is very good. And one last performance. Well, we've already talked about Linney and Hardin, who I think should have won the Oscar for this performance rather than Pollock, but whatever.
Okay.
But anyway, one last performance I want to mention, even though she's only in a couple scenes, and that's Emmy Rossum. These days, she's probably best remembered for her turn on the U.S. version of Shameless.
Yeah.
Now, she is someone who is... I think it's fair to say that she's comes from being, if not exactly very close to being to the manner born, or at least she comes off that way. Even though she was raised by a single mother, but she started out as an opera singer. And she knows several different languages, or she's performed operas in several different languages. She was in the long-delayed movie version of Phantom of the Opera. So she is not the first person that I would think of anyway to play this type of working class role, just as I wouldn't have necessarily thought of her for Shameless, but she's completely convincing in the role. And more importantly than that, she has to convey everything about the character in just a couple scenes. And she does that very well. So her death hangs over the entire movie.
Yeah, and you do have to you have to throw some credit her way, because this is a character who on the surface you think is pretty much like a throwaway. You could put anybody into that place, but that's not really the case. You know, you really do have to find the right person to carry off, you know, A, this relationship that she has with her father, and B, as you say, to be enough of a presence early in the film in those couple of scenes that we see her that she hovers over the whole rest of the thing.
All right. Now, one last thing I want to bring up before we wrap this rather long episode up. In addition to directing the movie, Clint Eastwood wrote the music for the movie, and it's nice and spare. And his son, Kyle, wrote the music that Katie and her friends are dancing to in the bar. Now, as I said, Eastwood is not a fan of modern music by any means. He likes jazz. But the music that they dance to in the bar, even though it's an all-instrumental track, does sound conceivably like something that they might get up and dance to.
Yeah, yeah.
So it works. Do you have anything else that you want to talk about where we wrap this up?
No, I have absolutely exhausted my notes here.
All right. So as I've alluded to, both of these movies are available on DVD. Lone Star is No Frills DVD. Whereas Mystic River, if you have the three-disc version, which I do, has a bunch of extras on it, including on the third disc is the soundtrack to the movie. However, if you prefer to watch them online, then you can stream Lone Star through Hoopla, if you get that through your library, or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, or most other streaming services. Whereas Mystic River, you can rent or buy through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, and most other streaming services.
Yeah, Lone Star DVD is so low, like, you know, it doesn't even have a menu. It just starts playing when you put it in the DVD player.
that's how a lot of Warner Brothers DVDs are when they don't have any special features.
Even Mystic River, like if you didn't select anything within a few seconds, the movie just started, but at least there was a menu. Yeah.
Yes, well, it has more special features. Now, Lone Star supposedly is getting the Criterion treatment, but now that's just a rumor. But speaking of which, for our next episode, we're going to be covering a couple of subversive adaptations. That is, movies that may follow the plot for the most part of the source material, but subvert the meaning of it very much. And those two movies are from 1955, Kiss Me Deadly, directed by Robert Aldrich, and from 1997, Starship Troopers, directed by Paul Verhoeven. Now, both of them are available on DVD. Kiss Me Deadly is available on a regular DVD, and then also the Criterion DVD. Unfortunately, you'll have to settle for that unless someone's bootlegged a copy on YouTube somewhere, because Kiss Me Deadly at the moment is not available for streaming, though you can pick up the DVD fairly cheap, or I would bet your local library has at least the Criterion one. Starship Troopers, you can currently stream on Netflix, or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, or most other streaming services. And we have our own website, wordsandmovies.com, and you can comment on our posts there. And if you have a question or a comment, you could also email us through wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. Or you can comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And I myself, under my name, Sean Gallagher, am also on Facebook. And how about you, Claude?
Well, you can find me on the Book of Face under my own name, Claude Cole. You can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com, and assorted social media from that.
All right, so thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much. Alex, please take us away.
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.